The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to this Thursday edition of The Dan Proft Show. Thank you for joining us. You get podcasts of the program, danproftshow.com, and follow us on social media at Dan Proft Show. We begin with a look ahead to CPAC this weekend, where President Trump is speaking on Sunday, much anticipated. Talk a little bit about what we hope to get from that speech. But before we even get to that, the question in Republican ranks and to Republican leadership yesterday, should he be speaking at CPAC at all? House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy had one answer, and House Conference Chairman Liz Cheney had another.
Do you believe President Trump should be speaking, or former President Trump should be speaking at CPAC this weekend?
Yes, he should.
Congresswoman Cheney?
That's up to CPAC. I've been clear in my views about President Trump and the extent to which following January 6th, I don't believe that he should be playing a role in the future of the party or the country.
On that high note, fun times for Kevin McCarthy and those never Trumpers within his caucus. I think he has there's probably more tension in the House Republican caucus than there is in the Senate Republican caucus under the stewardship of Mitch McConnell. Nonetheless, yes, he should be speaking at CPAC. And Liz Cheney, he should not have a voice in the future of the party or the country. Well, it'll be interesting to see if Wyoming voters think Liz Cheney should continue to have a voice in the future of the party in the state of Wyoming and at the federal level come Wyoming's primary next year and the challenge she faces. And by the way, those challenges to House Republicans who voted to impeach President Trump are starting to pick up, including Adam Kinzinger in my home state of Illinois, now facing an announced challenger who ran for Congress and narrowly lost a primary last cycle, young woman named Catalina Lauf. So you want to pay attention to that one, too. It could be a bellwether. If Kinzinger even decides to run again, that will be something else to watch. Some of those 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach, many of whom have been censured by their local Republican parties, or at least some of their local Republican Party organizations, whether or not they're on the ballot again in 2022. The larger question, of course, is the work that Liz Cheney and some of those Republicans are doing, the future of the Republican Party, which I assume and it should be addressed in pertinent part by President Trump on Sunday. And it was interesting against this backdrop, one more clip before I offer some comment, and that was Mitt Romney. He was on with the intolerable Andrew Ross Sorkin for this D.C. deal book thing. And he had this to say about the future of the party and Trump's role in it, even though he's not a supporter of Trump having a role in it. But it was the end, the last thing he said that I think is particularly important to pick up on and chat about a bit.
Will President Trump continue to play a role in my party? I'm sure he will. He has by far the largest voice and a big impact in my party. I don't know about his family members, whether they intend to do that, but I expect he will continue playing a role. I don't know if he'll run in 2024 or not, but if he does, I'm pretty sure he will win the nomination.
He would win the nomination?
Oh, I think he'd win the nomination if he runs. I mean, a lot can happen between now and 2024, so... And I'm not great at predicting. I subscribe to Yogi Berra's philosophy in that regard. He said, I don't like predicting, particularly if the future's involved. So I don't really know what'll happen there. But I look at the polls, and the polls show that among the names being floated as potential contenders in 2024, if you put President Trump in there among Republicans, he wins in a landslide.
Would you campaign against him?
I would not be voting for President Trump again. I haven't voted for him in the past, and I would probably be getting behind somebody who I thought more represented the tiny wing of the Republican Party that I represent.
Yeah, the last thing is the most interesting thing. I mean, all Mitt Romney was doing otherwise is describing what every survey that's taken indicates in terms of Trump's popularity among Republican voters and support he would have, at least initially, and he's right, 4 years is a long time, but at least initially from those who voted for him in 2020. But the last thing, the tiny wing of the party I represent, maybe Romney was trying to be self-effacing, but he's not inaccurate, is he? And the interesting thing is, why does he represent a tiny wing of the party? That would have been a good follow-up question, but that's beyond Andrew Ross Sorkin's capacity. Why do you think it is you represent a tiny wing of the party, essentially a fraction of the party, small fraction of the party? And I'm not just talking about because you're the senator from Utah. I'm talking about approach. Is there something to take away from that? Maybe it's because when the Biden administration and the Democrat Socialists proposed spending $1.9 trillion in funny money, Mitt Romney counters with $600 billion in funny money. Maybe it's because when the Democrat Socialists propose a $15 federal minimum wage, Mitt Romney counters with a $10 federal minimum wage. Maybe it's because Republicans, the rank-and-file Republicans, the base of the party, has tired of Republicans who slow walk socialism, start from the premises of the left. They're on the same path to the same place. They just want to go at a bit of a slower gait. Maybe there's a bit of a frustration with that because pre-Trump, things haven't been, that approach has not been working out well for middle-income families in America, has it? Not to mention it runs counter to the philosophical foundation of the party as a free enterprise party. You can't slow walk. I mean, you can try. You can take the rhetorical position in support of the free enterprise system. But the longer you slow walk socialism, the more people sort of catch wind of the two-step that you're doing. So maybe that's why Mitt Romney has been marginalized. And the other reason that surrender Republicans like Liz Cheney are being marginalized is because they're starting from the rhetorical characterization of the Republican Party by the Democrat Socialists. So on the one hand, you have Romney starting from their policy premises. On the other hand, you have Cheney starting from their caricature of the party. This is a very good piece by David Marcus, Liz Cheney, over at thefederalist.com, I should add. Liz Cheney must explain why she thinks the GOP is a white supremacist party. And he quotes her from an event at the Reagan Institute. It's very important, especially for us as Republicans, to make clear we aren't the party of white supremacy. You certainly saw anti-Semitism on January 6th. You saw the symbols of the Holocaust denial. You saw a Confederate flag being carried through the rotunda. We as Republicans in particular have a duty and an obligation to stand against that, to stand against insurrection. Well, first of all, those individuals who committed acts of violence, who broke the law on January 6th, are not representative of the Republican Party. But as Marcus points out, Liz Cheney knows exactly how that twaddle will be repurposed by the left to advance their caricature of the Republican Party as some white supremacist party, particularly if, you know, Trump has any involvement with it. But it doesn't require Trump any more than it required Trump to refer to George W. Bush as a Nazi and every Republican president or even candidate before and since, including Mitt Romney, ironically. They don't need the truth to cast aspersions, do they? So Liz Cheney is just giving them fodder. This is the enemy inside the perimeter problem that the Republican Party has at the federal level to some extent now, that we've seen, and I've certainly experienced it in states like Illinois, where the Republican Party has ceased to exist because they've ceded the characterization of their own party to the other side, as well as the policy agenda to the other side. Well, then why do you exist if you're going to cede your entire identity, both sort of philosophically and as manifested in your policy agenda? What's the point? And you start to ask that question, and a lot of people say, yeah, right, there is no point because there's no difference. So why throw in with them? It's sort of a remarkable admission from Mitt Romney that I wouldn't mind seeing Trump pick up on in his remarks on Sunday and explain to Mitt Romney and the rest of the party just exactly why Mitt Romney represents that tiny wing of the party that he described. This is Dan Proff.
Sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. If you're a bit confused as to what the trajectory of COVID-19 is at present and what that means in terms of the way we live, then it's understandable. You have every reason to believe, to feel that way, because getting a lot of information that runs counter. Ashish Jha, who's the dean of Brown University School of Public Health, speaking to Joe Pinsker at The Atlantic, telling him that in a month or so, in the absence of a variant-driven surge, he, the dean of Brown University School of Public Health, would probably be comfortable going to a friend's house for a drink, mask-free and indoors, if he and his friend were both fully vaccinated. Quoting him, as we get into late spring, a lot of that stuff, the smaller gatherings of vaccinated people, I think starts becoming quite possible. The overall tenor of this Atlantic piece, though, where the staff writer interviewed a bunch of public health professionals like that gentleman from Brown University, was this: an uncertain spring, an amazing summer, a cautious fall and winter, and then finally in 2022, relief. Which is not inconsistent with what Tony Fauci has been proclaiming either, considering the advisory that we may be wearing masks and social distancing into 2022, that just because you're vaccinated doesn't mean you should be doing things like dining indoors or going to movie theaters. That despite the fact that in some of the states that have had the most severe lockdowns, restaurants may not be at full capacity, but they're at 35 or 50% capacity. And yet, even if you've been vaccinated, you still shouldn't be going to eat indoors. Doesn't that strike one as curious? The lockdown then until 2022, until we have information that guarantees what we suspect to be true, that if you're vaccinated, you're unlikely to be spreading the virus. And then also understanding all of that in the context of the piece we talked about a bit earlier in the week in the Wall Street Journal by Dr. Marty Makary, who projects that based on the COVID case drop, based on a reasonable interpolation of those who have natural immunity combined with the population that has gotten infected and survived the infection, and then the 15% or so of Americans who've been vaccinated at present, with more vaccinations like the Johnson & Johnson single-shot vaccine coming online this week, that we're looking at herd immunity as soon as April. So we'd have herd immunity potentially on that timeline, but it's going to be a precarious spring and a hopeful rest of the year, but nothing clear until 2022? Well, who deserves what? I mean, I'm just trying to process the information in terms of what the science and the data tells us, since everybody has become so science and data obsessed. So what does the science and data tell us? And what How should we be interpreting it? For example, this conversation we've had from the beginning. Should we continue to take the posture of those who were cheerleaders for lockdowns? Many still are, including schools, despite the mountains of evidence. Should we take the posture that we live life based on the worst case scenario, or we live our lives based on the most likely scenario? And so what does the science and data tell us about the most likely scenario if that's the standard by which we should live our lives? For more on that, we're pleased to be joined now by the author of that piece in the journal I mentioned, Dr. Marty Makary, professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health. He's the chief medical advisor to Sesame Care and author of the award-winning The Price We Pay. Dr. Makary, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you guys.
So can you help us distill pieces that suggest that things are getting better, but don't expect anything resembling pre-COVID normalcy until 2022, with you suggesting we're tracking for herd immunity in April and Tony Fauci saying we're wearing masks until then? You get the point.
Yeah, there's a lot of messages out there, and I think some of them are designed to calibrate expectations. I think there's some things that nobody knows. Nobody knows what the fall is going to look like. I think we're all cautious, but we're thinking of it as maybe what would normally look like a bad flu season. We'll see what the variants look like. You know, with the flu season, we're not very good at predicting. Some years the flu season is bad, much worse than we thought, and the vaccine doesn't work well. And other years it's mild and the vaccine works well. So I think right now people want to know, like, when can I get with my parents or the kids? When can they get some semblance of normalcy? And I do think that one trend that we're seeing in the data that the experts are not talking about is that natural immunity from prior infection is far more common than we thought. That there's a lot of people out there walking around with either antibodies or activated T cells, even if they don't have the antibodies. There's a study from Karolinska Institute in Sweden that shows you're twice as likely to have these activated T cells and be immune than you are to have just the antibodies. And we've based our prevalence studies on the antibody test. So it turns out probably one of the reasons for the massive 77% decline over the last month and a half is that a lot of people have some natural immunity from prior infection. I think there's sometimes when we got to use common sense.
This common sense you speak of, I think we've become unfamiliar with the concept because, I mean, sort of as you're pointing out, yes, interestingly, unlike some of these TV doctors, can I speak with metaphysical certitude on it? No. Is it highly likely that this is the case? Yes. Is there research that indicates that it's more likely than not that this is the case, for example, on spreading after being vaccinated? Yes. But that's not good enough in some quarters. And it seems to me there needs to be more vociferous pushback to those who essentially seem to be arguing that we can't resume normalcy until there is zero COVID, which is an impossibility.
Well, I think we've lost sight of our goal. Our goal should be to maximize human health, health outcomes, and our livelihoods. It's not to extinguish the virus, because if we chase that thing, we're never going to win. And there are health consequences to some of the stuff that we call for. So look at the data points that no one has ever died after a vaccine has fully kicked in. Okay? Take that data point. Take the fact that the trial results are really good, and we're not getting the right messages, right? We're hearing, you know, yesterday on the J&J vaccine that it's, you know, 80-some percent effective. Well, it's 100% effective in preventing COVID death, and it was 100% effective in preventing hospitalization from COVID once you get 4 weeks out from the vaccine. So let's put things in context and recognize the reality that people are dying of loneliness, that this is an epidemic problem, that substance abuse and mental illness and deferred medical care, kids are 10 times more likely to die of suicide than they are of coronavirus. And we've got to put things in context. I think to some degree we've lost our way.
When we come back with Johns Hopkins University's Dr. Marty Makary, I want to continue on this topic of fear over facts and reason, and get your reflections on it, Doctor. More with Marty Makary right after this. It's a nice day to start again. Come on, it's a
nice day for a white wedding. Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. We're speaking with Johns Hopkins University's Dr. Marty Makary, talking about, in part, the pronounced fear of COVID, enthusiastic fear of COVID in certain quarters in America, a bit of addiction to fear, if you will. And perhaps this is something that Theodore Dalrymple aptly described as you know, frisson, this idea of overcoming something, feeling like you're in this fight and you're overcoming something that actually really doesn't present that much of a threat. And so there's sort of a thrill-seeking aspect to it. I don't want to play armchair psychologist, so I'll rely on him. And so as a segue, I wanted you to address something you addressed in your piece in the Wall Street Journal, because this is sort of the latest category of use to promote fear, and that is mutations of the virus. And we've seen this over the last several weeks now. This mutation of the virus could soon be the most prevalent manifestation of COVID. This mutation of the virus may be vaccine resistance, and so on and so forth. And you addressed the variants in your piece.
Let's look at the track record of people who are saying this stuff. It's sort of like you're watching a financial analyst and you could see their average return for the prior year. And if they lost 15% consistently every year, you'd say, why am I listening to this? Look at the folks who said, you know, the pandemic wasn't going to be a big deal. Look at what folks have said. And what you realize here is that there is a bit of a pattern, exactly what you're saying, Dan. Now, I'll tell you, I'm taking the variants very seriously, but let's look at the data. In the UK, where the UK variant is dominant, what's happening to cases there? They're down 84%. Brazil's a little more concerning. They're having a little more persistence with the P1 strain, but that's not the strain that anyone projects to be dominant in the US. And what's it mean if it's the dominant strain? If there's 5 cases a month or a day, it may not be a big public health threat if that's the dominant strain with a very low case number.
Yeah, I mean, common sense and track records, these are revolutionary ideas these days. I was at an event for the American Cancer Society. They were giving a briefing to this, you know, donor class that was in attendance at the event. It was dominated by COVID. I mean, they started talking about the progress with respect to eradicating HPV and things that were actually cancer-related. But then it sort of turned to COVID, and it was sort of dominated by COVID, even to the exclusion of talking about things that other medical professionals have talked about that have been really serious trade-offs that have been made, things like the sort of healthcare infrastructure to serve people with preventative cancer screenings, not to mention actually procedures, certainly at the front of the pandemic. And also the fear mongering that we're sort of talking about that has kept people who should be going for screenings, regular treatments and so forth away from hospitals. I mean, this is the American Cancer Society. I just came away from that scratching my head saying, how can somebody get so politicized, so lost in this that they forget what the mission of their organization is?
Well, I think we have a society that's obsessed with laboratory pharmaceutical discoveries. And as someone who is a cancer surgeon by background, I spend most of my time in public health research now, but in that field of cancer, we spend $100 billion a year all on laboratories, never on the environmental exposures that could cause cancer, never on these concerning trends, never on food as medicine and how to take care of a person rather than just try to extinguish a cancer cell. And that is the society that we live in. That's why we got nailed on COVID, because we didn't spend any money on basic clinical research, bedside research that doctors needed to understand how many people are asymptomatic, do masks work. Instead, we spent $60 billion last year on laboratory stuff. You know, give us a pill to fix our problems. And we need to do that stuff. I'm not downplaying it. And the vaccines were great. But why are we learning in July from Florida Atlantic University that a mask on a mannequin emitting blue gas, or sorry, green gas, if you remember those images that we got showing us the studies. Why are we learning in July? Why are we learning that indoor gatherings is where it spreads in August? Why are we doing the studies on where people got COVID in September? And there's this vacuum that we left. And guess what happens in a highly opinionated country like ours? Opinions and just dominate and they move in. And so we forgot about basic bedside clinical research. And we spent all our money, you know, give us a pharmaceutical solution for everything. I think there's good news right now. People should be, you know, they should be. It's terrible to talk about good news when we hit a 500,000 milestone, but there's some good news on the horizon.
Dr. Marty Makary, professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health, chief medical advisor to Sesame Care and author of the award-winning The Price We Pay. Dr. Makary, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Great. Good to be with you guys.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. What is with New York? Spitzer, Wiener, now Cuomo, nipple rings Gambino, as I like to reference him. The New York Post is the first to publicly call for Andrew Cuomo's impeachment. They did so in an editorial yesterday. It is not just because of the nursing home scandal, although that's a big part of it, as well it should be. It also is because of the latest in a series of charges that have been made over the last couple of months by a former aide to Governor Cuomo named Lindsay Bolin, who suggests in some detail that he was sort of a serial sexual, not sort of, he was a serial sexual harasser of hers. She wrote a 1,700-word piece in Medium at medium.com. Let's play strip poker. That's how it opens. I should have been shocked by the governor's crude comment, but I wasn't. We were flying home from an October 2017 event in Western New York on his taxpayer-funded jet. He was seated facing me, so close our knees almost touched. His press aide was to my right and state trooper behind us. That's exactly what I was thinking, I responded sarcastically and awkwardly. I tried to play it cool, but in that moment, I realized just how acquiescent I had become. She goes on to say that Nipple Rings Gambino has created a culture within his administration where sexual harassment and bullying is so pervasive that it is not only condoned but expected. His inappropriate behavior toward women was an affirmation that he liked you, that you must be doing something right. He used intimidation to silence his critics, and if you dared speak up, you would face consequences. Now, and she also goes on with other to make other specific allegations, like that he kissed her on the lips, unwanted kiss on the lips, to congratulate her for a promotion that she got within his office, which is, of course, wildly inappropriate. To be fair, disputed, there are aides to Cuomo who say there was no such flight where she would have been only with the governor and that state trooper, that there would have been other aides. Other aides were on those flights, and they don't report anything like what she described. So I don't know what the truth is, but I know what the posture of the left is with respect to allegations like this, depending on who the target is, right? If it's one of ours, the benefit of the doubt is warranted. If it's not one of ours, then you must believe the woman, right? So, of course, that hypocrisy notwithstanding, we give everybody the benefit of the doubt because that's consistent with due process norms in a free society. But the level of specificity is something that requires some investigation. Yeah, sure. Pile up the investigations on this guy. And by the way, the suggestion that he is boorish and ill-tempered and attempts to intimidate, a bully, if you will, I despise that word because it's become rendered virtually meaningless through overuse and misapplication. However, you can suggest that he behaves inappropriately or is a difficult person to work with at minimum, belying the fun-loving nature that he provides in role-playing games with Tony Fauci during his Emmy Award-winning daily press briefings on COVID, of course. But Mayor Warren Wilhelm, again, his character hardly beyond reproach, what he has to say is relevant, not so insofar as Democrats are also starting to bail on nipple rings Gambino. And, you know, you get a lot of your own party starting to bail on you, combined with Republicans who are echoing the sentiments that you find in the New York Post from their editorial board. And maybe you got a guy who's in jeopardy legally per these investigations into his catastrophic decision making and lying about it with respect to nursing homes, and also politically.
That's classic Andrew Cuomo. A lot of people in New York State have received those phone calls. You know, the bullying is nothing new. I believe Ron Kim, and it's very, very sad. No public servant, no person who's telling the truth should be treated that way. But yeah, that the threats, the belittling, the demand that someone change their statement right that moment, many, many times. I've heard that, and I know a lot of other people in this state have heard that.
Right, and he's referring to Ron Kim, who we talked about on this show, the state assemblyman from Queens, and who gave an interview about the phone call he received. There's also a piece from Morgan Peem, if I'm pronouncing his name right. Documentary filmmaker, served as editor-in-chief of City and State from 2012 to 2014. He recounts in the New York Post how Cuomo, quote, terrorized me for doing my job as a journalist. He writes, while the April 2014, he talks about an April 2014 call he received, not directly from the governor, but he knew where it was coming from. He was about to publish a story exposing Cuomo's machinations to distort a report that was going to be issued on public corruption in New York State. He writes, the manipulation we documented put the lie to the governor's public proclamation that it would be a fully independent body with the authority to probe graft in Albany wherever he found it. In reality, as soon as the commission touched the governor's own office, he hastily shut it down. And so there was this guy reporting on this. Then he gets the call. He writes that he doesn't recall precisely everything that was hurled at him. And it was, interestingly, by the same aide who made the disclosure and apology to members, Democrat members of the state assembly, about not providing them timely and accurate information about deaths at nursing homes because they were afraid to implicate themselves criminally, is essentially what you said. But it's the same woman, DeRosa. He writes, 7 years later, I don't recall precisely everything DeRosa hurled at me, though I'm positive she vowed to, quote, destroy, unquote, my career and take revenge on my publication. I remember vividly how I felt, which was afraid. I had no reason to think these threats were idle. I was fully aware of the governor's volcanic temper and track record of vindictiveness. If he wanted to crush me, he could and likely would. Boy, it just couldn't happen to a more deserving target than Nipple Rings Gambino, could it? He is the reason, Andrew Cuomo, the reason the word Schadenfreude was invented. This is Dan Proft. Come on.
DanProftShow.com.
Welcome back to the show. Going from one disreputable politician to another, Blue State Andrew Cuomo, Blue City Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot. This is fun. Lightfoot on a call with members of the Chicago City Council and had to indulge one of the self-described socialists, this alderman, is affiliated with the Democrat Socialists of America. Her name is Rosanna Rodriguez Sanchez. And she took her time on the Zoom conversation to tell everybody how much she loved black people, you know, in commemoration of Black History Month. And boy, Lori Lightfoot, who is happy to traffic in identitarian politics, certainly has a difficult time indulging it when it's not coming from her.
I really hope that as lawmakers and people committed to transformation, we will be able to continue to fight for a more equitable, a more just, a more a space where we can all be free, a space where black people feel safe, a space where we can all thrive. And that starts with the liberation of black people. Until that happens, none of us will be free. I'm very grateful for the contributions of all black people that have come before. And I'm really thankful for all my colleagues and all the black people that have contributed to make this city a better place for all. Thank you, Madam.
You're gotta be f***ing kidding me. Thank you, Alderwoman. The chair recognizes Alderman Jim Garden.
You got to be effing kidding me now. Of course, Mayor Triple Threat, as she describes herself, and I've obliged by making that her moniker. I wasn't talking about what the alderman had to say, the alderwoman had to say, whatever. I was referencing something I had received from staff. Right. Yeah. Okay. But remember, this is a mayor who called herself the Triple Threat as a candidate for mayor. Why is she a triple threat? Because she's black, female, lesbian. High intersectionality score. But it's exhausting, isn't it, Mayor Lightfoot, triple threat, to listen to some sentimental dum-dum prattle on with patronizing pablum? Isn't it? Is it just so exhausting? The funny thing about Lightfoot, for those outside of Chicago, don't pay much of other than a passing attention to it, is Lightfoot doesn't believe in this identitarian stuff. She just uses it out of convenience for political expediency's purpose, which makes her complicit. And so she gets back what she gives. Now, we here at the Dan Prof Show were able to exclusively obtain the additional exchange that happened after the exchange you just heard. Take a listen.
I love black people!
I love black people!
Who's your mother, Jerry?
You, my mother,
what you gonna do, Jerry?
Show me the money!
It's tough to parody Lightfoot and members of the Chicago City Council, so we do our best. This is Dan Prof.
This is the Dan Prof Show. The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Prof, and this is the Dan Prof Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Please follow us at danprofshow.com and on social media at Dan Prof Show. Are we fractured as a country in an unprecedented way? You know, America's been through a lot. There are always divisions in the country. So is what we see in 2021 America so novel? Lance Morrow tried to tackle that issue in a Wall Street Journal piece, Seeing Red and Feeling Blue, about just exactly where the national mood is, something that commentators like to describe as if it's easy to apply one mood to 330 million people. It's not. And he gives some historical context. While historical context is still allowed, well, we still recognize that we have 2,500 years of history. And he zeroes in on one thing that is different from the divisions of the past: screens. And why don't we start there with Lance Morrow, who is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, essayist for Time magazine for many years. He's the author of the soon-to-be-released God and Mammon, Chronicles of American Money. Lance Morrow, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So when we're trying to provide some perspective here as people are talking openly about, you know, the crack-up of the republic, we've been through a lot of trials and tribulations, a lot of dark periods in American history before. This is certainly one of them. But you suggest there is something that is different, and that is screens, that is the digital universe. How does that make it different, and what do you think the implications are of that difference?
Well, I think the screens make it a lot more dangerous in many ways. You can call it the democratization of information, but you can also call it the mobization of information. In other words, it is very, the phenomenon of cancel culture and ganging up on these ideological attacks on people centered around race and gender, especially. This increases the intensity and the acceleration of these public moods. It concentrates them in a way that a magnifying glass will concentrate sunlight and cause a fire. And I think it's hard to figure out exactly how dangerous things are now, but it seems to me that it's a very alarming business to see how quickly this convergence of the pandemic and many other factors, the intensity and the one thing on top of another, has produced a volatility which I think is extremely unusual, and you'd have to go back to 1860 or something. But I do point out in the piece, the country has always operated by binaries almost. There's always been north and south and black and white and east and west. But now, as I said, because of the screens, it seems to me that we're in new territory, and particularly with the pandemic laid on top of everything else.
It seems to me what we have is what we've had previously in America, and it's always been a catastrophe. We have a new racial order, and now we've expanded beyond race to other identitarian-driven orders, as you were sort of describing, gender, sexual orientation, and so forth. So we're compounding the errors that we've made in the past through things like slavery and Jim Crow. When you have the combination of corporate America, and that certainly includes big tech, which may be more powerful than the government, which I also think a bit of a novelty in American history. Certainly,
yeah, that's a big factor. Yeah, you're absolutely right to mention that.
Those combined forces are aligning to eliminate whiteness among other agenda items. This is the new facade of the cultural Marxists. And that has to force a moment at some point.
Well, what do you mean by force a moment?
I mean, I don't know exactly what I mean.
By the way, I'm not quite. I think you may be downplaying Trump a little bit. I mean, he's still got a huge following, and that's he can tip the center of gravity in ways that you could have a 1912 situation. Remember 1912, the Bull Moose Party, Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft were against Woodrow Wilson, and Wilson won because Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moosers split the Republican vote, and you could see that again in 2024.
I agree with that. I mean, in terms of electoral outcomes, but what I'm saying is, and I think what I read from your piece is you're saying is that this is much bigger than a singular election. This is a cultural divide.
Absolutely.
And I mean, you reference, to reference something from your piece. At worst, our tremendous mood will collide with one another. It was no use for Abraham Lincoln to appeal in his first inaugural to the mystic chords of memory, to a reverence for the history that Americans had in common. Too late, the country went ahead with civil war. I'm not suggesting that's inevitable here, but I'm suggesting it's possible.
Yeah, I'm amazed at the seeming speed with which there's been this tremendous disintegrative pattern. Civilization is a thin veneer, and democracy is even thinner, people talk about it. I mean, the possibilities of violence are very. One of the examples that I think of is the French religious wars in the 16th century, when the Huguenots and the Catholics were at each other's throats for 40 or 50 years, and it wasn't an organized big battlefront kind of civil war the way that the American Civil War was, but it was more skirmishes and outbreaks and an occasional massacre and so on. But there was a great deal of disorder, and the body politic was just split in a very terrible way, and it was a long before that resolved itself. And I worry that the cultural difference in America is really huge. I mean, it's just the cobra and mongoose, and it's a two different species almost. I don't know if you agree with that.
I think that's what we're getting at. And you see it, you know, something to, you know, be shocked at, but sort of dismiss 30 years ago, 25 years ago when I was in college, what was happening at college campuses. Now it's in K-12. Now it's in corporate boardrooms. Now it's in all of our cultural and artistic and civic institutions. And, you know, you have seminars, whiteness is, you know, is basically being a thuggish jerk. And look what Frederick Douglass said, you know, I don't want to be part of a system that confers benefits and imposes responsibilities based on race, because somebody's going to be on the short end of that stick. And that's a powder keg. That's essentially the point that he made. That's the point that King made. And we're doing it again. It's just a different shape of a powder keg.
It's really shocking. And it's also the stupidity that's loose in this country. That's another factor that one should talk about. Stupidity is a very interesting subject, and there is a tremendous amount of sheer stupidity at work. And when you combine stupidity with ideology, you're really headed for terrible trouble.
It's a witch's brew.
And when you're talking about white fragility and white supremacy and all that stuff, there are, you know, obviously there is a problem with racism, but when you begin these bizarre doctrinaire ideological generalizations about white fragility and so on, it is very damaging.
And something else that seems a bit unique in American history, to the extent that it is occurring, is the elimination of American history.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the ignorance of American history is the canceling of American history. Not only American, you know, but Western civilization itself. I mean, it's incomprehensible to me that although I understand the motive, but, you know, that people acquiesced in throwing out a couple thousand years of a very hard-won intellectual accomplishment and scientific accomplishment and literary accomplishment, as Shakespeare and all the rest. That's incomprehensible to me. And yet I know the motive. The motive is to claim the slate and subdue the prevailing former culture and make it the former indeed, and replace it with something else. Be careful what you wish for.
Maybe Harvard University epidemiologist Martin Kulldorff is right. You know, the Age of Enlightenment had a good run, 300 years or so, and now it's over. So there it is. Lance Morrow.
I don't think we should accept that. But.
No, I'm being facetious. God, I hope not.
Yes, I know.
Lance Morrow, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, essayist at Time for many years, the soon-to-be-released new book, God and Mammon, Chronicles of American Money. Lance Morrow, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Enjoy.
I've done everything for you. You've done nothing for me. I've done everything for you. You've done nothing.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and we're spending, unfortunately, a lot of time over the last year talking about so many kids having such difficulty with their education at the K-12 level because of the Zoom learning and the resistance from teachers' unions to get kids back in the classrooms around the country and so forth. They're stunting, really, has been conceded, really, across the ideological spectrum, the stunting of kids' intellectual and social development, and the negative impacts on their mental health as well by being isolated from their classmates and from a school environment. Well, we also want to profile stories of success, models that should continue to be replicated and scaled. And that is, in particular, with respect to competition at the K through 12 level. I've spoken a lot about that as parents are picking their heads up and looking around and saying, well, if my local public school is not going to serve my kids' needs, then it's time to find other options. And there are other options out there and support for those options in many states. So trying to profile success and provide human examples of it so that people know this is possible. And for help in doing that, we have another success story to feature. That is of Ashley Elliott, who is a Voices for Choice liaison and Future Leaders Fellow with the American Federation for Children. She joined us now. Ashley, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. How are you today?
Good, good. A pleasure to have you. And so you're from Florida. That's where you were educated. And you're a school choice success story, and it wasn't without incident, your K through 12 education. Why don't you share a little bit of the challenges you had growing up and getting through school and the opportunities that were provided that made the difference?
Yeah. So, one, I want to thank you for having me. And I'll get started on that. So basically I grew up in a small town called Lakeland, Florida. And, I was adopted by my grandmother, luckily. And the reason for that is my birth parents were on drugs. So I can say, you know, my life didn't necessarily start out easy,
mm-hmm.
but my grandmother who adopted us, she adopted me, my brother, and my cousin, and she wanted to give us the best life possible. But unfortunately, you can only do so much when you weren't planning to have kids in your 60s, you know?
Right. Yeah. Fair enough.
To say the least, like, she wasn't capable of, like, providing a lot, but, you know, the bare necessities, stuff like that. But she always wanted us to get into the best schools that she possibly could find for us. So when I was going into middle school, she got us into the School of Technology. And at the time, you know, like, technology was more expensive then than it is now. And at a technology school, we weren't able to flourish as well because we didn't have the money for electricity, much less, you know, the money for a computer or things needed for that class or environment. So that, along with problems at home and in-school bullying, stuff like that, I started to fail. And I'd never failed before in my life. So I was really devastated. And I didn't know what to do.
And what grade were you in at this time when you started to struggle?
I started to struggle in sixth grade,
okay.
but I stayed in the school until eighth grade, to my eighth grade year. And I remember we had this parent-teacher conference in my eighth grade year, and only two teachers thought that I was worth trying for. So they believe, they're like, yeah, Ashley can still, you know, she can make this up. She can still work hard and we can change this and we can turn it around. But the others were like, no, she needs help somewhere else. So we decided that it would be better for me to go to an alternative school where it's basically where kids play catch up. So if you have bad grades, they send you here. You're supposed to get those grades remedied. So I went to that school, and that school was it's in a different city. About an hour away, so on a bus ride, that's an hour and a half to 2 hours, depending. So I went there every day, starting from eighth grade until my 10th grade year. And while I was there, it was really bad. You have a lot of kids from a lot of similar backgrounds where either the parents aren't there or they're taking care of their sisters and their brothers all by themselves, and they're just going through a lot of things. And then you put them all in one environment, and they feed off of what each other person is going through. And so these teachers at the school they just thought we were all bad kids. And they didn't want to really put up with us. So, and we didn't want to put up with them. So yeah. While I was there, I went from being a very good student to failing again. And then cursing at my teachers, graffitiing the walls. My principal makes this joke that my initials are still on the wall to this day. I would skip class, and then it all kind of culminated whenever I got into this fight with a boy because I thought he pushed me. So, it wasn't going well, to say the least. And I felt like I didn't really have anybody. It felt like a lot of the teachers were just there to see me fail, not to see me get help. And then in my ninth grade year, there was a teacher named Miss Perez who came there, and she really, you know, she really saw a lot in me. And when that fight happened, I went to her and I was like freaking out because my mom, my grandmother, she bought me a phone, right? And during the fight, I lost this phone. And for someone who has no money, this phone meant everything. I knew that she'd spent $100 on this phone, so I was going crazy trying to find it. And I'm crying, and like Miss Perez, she takes me into this side classroom and she's like, what's going on? I'm like, I need to find my phone. I need to find my phone. And she's like, no, what's going on? And I just lost it. And I cried and I told her everything that was going on in my life, which will more, it's more than will fit in your show. But, so Miss Perez invested in me. She was one of the only teachers that did. And then at the end of my 10th grade year, she tells me she's leaving. And I was beyond devastated. I was like, there's no way that I can do anything now. I'm just going to fail. Miss Perez is gone. And then she tells me she wants me to come with her. And I was like, really? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, well, where are you going? She's like, I'm going to Victory Christian Academy in Lakeland, which is not too far away from where I live. And I was like, oh, a private school? And she's like, yeah, no, Ashley, give it a chance. Go do an interview with a teacher and we can see about getting you in. And I was like, okay. So her and my principal of my former school were transferring to this school. And what I didn't realize at the time is that private school is not like public school in the aspect that you have to pay for it.
Right.
So I, you know, kids don't think about these things most of the time. So we go to the school and I do an interview. Before, you know, I didn't really know that before I even showed up that the headmaster had already accepted me. But I did an interview. Miss Perez vouched for me and my principal, Mr. Thomas, vouched for me. Basically, they're like, she's a kid who's going through a hard time, but every kid deserves a chance, right? So I went in to the interview, discussed everything, got in, and they're like, okay, well, you're into the school now. Now we have to get you to be able to pay for it.
She is Ashley Elliott, a Voices for Choice liaison, future leaders fellow at the American Federation for Children, and as you heard, quite the success story herself. Ashley, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your story and continued success at college and beyond.
Thank you for having me.
This portion is sponsored by the American Federation for Children, the nation's largest school choice advocacy organization, helping every family choose the best K-12 education for their children. Find them on social media at School Choice Now. That's at School Choice Now.
Political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. We continue to try to bring you, at minimum, anecdotal stories to buttress the overwhelming data and evidence about the state of K-12 education, as so many parents are becoming awakened to the state of their kids' schools and who exactly is in charge, and perhaps even some questioning if they can't get their kids back to school, maybe they shouldn't want their kids back into school in the first place, taking a hard look that maybe they hadn't taken prior to this disruption in their kids' education, such as it is. And so the latest example comes again from California. La Mesa Spring Valley School Board meeting, voting. Here we are a year later from the outset and the school closures. La Mesa Spring Valley School Board voting meeting, a Zoom meeting, on whether or not to reopen their schools. And Vice President of the school board, Sharda Bell Fontenot, who describes herself as a black feminista, quote unquote, suggesting that even having the conversation was inappropriate, an example of white privilege, and she won't be party to it.
And I know that what we're doing is wrong. So how are we forcing people? That seems like a very white supremacist ideology to force people to comply with, you know, and conform. Just letting them know. Privilege. Check it, guys. So I don't want to be a part of forcing anybody to do anything they don't want to do. That's what slavery is. I'm not going to be a part of it. Like, nobody even knows, none of you guys even know what we're talking about right now. This seems like a mess. We should not be voting on this tonight. You guys don't have all the information that you need. You guys are just saying what you're speaking from your heart, and that's fine.
The superintendent took issue with her characterizing other fellow board members as not knowing what they're talking about, and so on and so forth. And the school board president chimed in to try to move this along. You know, you have that conversation offline with the superintendent, and that generated this.
I think this should be a private conversation between.
No, it doesn't need to be private. None of this needs to be private. Racism doesn't need to be private, Becky.
Racism doesn't need to be private, Becky. And that's what reopening schools is an indicia of, racism. For more on this, the state of education, pre-K through post-secondary, pleased to be joined again by Anthony Esselin, professor and writer in residence at Magdalen College of the Liberal Arts, author of The Hundredfold, Songs for the Lord, and Sex and the Unreal City, The Demolition of the Western Mind. Tony, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Well, maybe Ms. Belfontenot has accidentally lurched into an insight. She's not supportive of forcing anybody to do anything. Maybe we should start, as you sort of suggest in a recent piece at amgreatness.com, maybe we should start by not forcing children to go to school until age 18 straight away.
Yeah, you know what? We didn't used to have compulsory schooling, right? He was secular, I believe. I don't think he was religious, but a fellow named John Taylor Gatto wrote for years about state of literacy in New York around 1800 or 1790, so, you know, near the founding of this country, which was, and the state of literacy was basically universal. Unless you were feeble-minded, if you were an adult in New York, you could read. And being able to read then meant that you were able to read the texts that were the only texts around to read. So you could read the newspapers of the time, the Federalist Papers, Pilgrim's Progress, the King James Bible, and so forth. Texts that a lot of our college students now would find rather challenging, rather difficult. He had said a long time ago, move to make schooling compulsory, beginning in Massachusetts in the mid-1800s, was a move towards turning America towards the ideal of Prussia, a centrally organized state with control of education, increasing control of education from farther and farther away from the people who are meant to suffer the education. You know, I began to think, what good does it exactly do to force young people to be in a school until they're 18 years old? What are they learning there? What are they not learning because they're there? And we just take for granted, well, of course, yeah, everybody should be in school. Really? So I've been finding out about the lives of very ordinary people before compulsory schooling through age 18 or age 16 was basically universal across the country. People did a lot of things.
Yeah, Tony, let's hold it right there. And when we come back, I want to talk about not only your daughter's choir, but also Oliver Ditson and some of the folks that accomplished a great deal without being required to go to school until age 18. More with Tony Esselin right up there.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. We're speaking with Anthony Esselin, professor and writer in residence at Magdalen College of the Liberal Arts and author of The Hundredfold, Songs for the Lord, as well as Sex and the Unreal City, The Demolition of the Western Mind. Before the break, talking about this notion of compulsory education, and as we're reexamining so much with respect to education, maybe the compulsory nature of K through 12 should be reexamined. And Tony, I'll let you pick it up from there. Maybe tell us a little bit about Oliver Ditson as yet another example of informal, I guess, education, what that can produce.
Yeah, well, my daughter sang in a self-isolation choir, and a choir of people singing, contributing their voices from all over the world, singing an oratorio by Mendelssohn, the Elijah. And so I'm looking at the text that she's singing from. It was produced around 1850 by the Oliver Ditson Company. And I'm looking at the ads in the inside pages. Holy cow. We're talking about hundreds of books, really sophisticated books, being marketed to ordinary Americans. So I did a little bit of a search for Mr. Ditson, the owner of the company. And I find out that he graduated from grammar school at age 11, which was, you know, common thing, and he went straight into business. He began to work for a man who ran a bookstore and music store. And by age 22, he's a full partner in this man's business. By age 22. And by the time he's in his 40s, he buys out his partner. The partner goes separate ways. They begin to sell musical instruments and to repair them, while Ditson focuses mainly on publication. And he becomes one of the foremost publishers of music in America in the 19th century. And that's a big deal. Sheet music, it's the way, you know, the way you're going to experience music is if you hear somebody play it or you play it yourself. There are no tape recorders or things like that. And the thing about Ditson's story is not that it was remarkable. It's that it wasn't remarkable. That is, lots of people did this sort of thing, okay? And then I ask myself, if it was done then, why can it not be done now, right? And people will say, well, you know, it's because there's so much more to learn. And I said, really? Is that really true? Have you actually taken a look at books that were written for mechanics, machinists in 1910, 1900? You're telling me that these people who very rarely had any higher education at all, that these people then could only do simple things, but things are they're so much more complicated now, you have to go to college. I don't see that. And if I don't see it with regard to machinists, I surely don't see it with regard to most everybody else.
Well, and this is the pushback you would receive, of course, is, well, you know, but we have child labor laws now, Tony, and we don't want children to be exploited. And unfortunately, not everybody has a two parent family that is providing the mentorship that you're providing for your daughter, and not everybody has the opportunity that Oliver Ditson had, and so on and so forth. And this is where we need more of a paternalist society to make sure that no child is left behind.
Well, the funny thing is that the schools themselves, as we know, the schools themselves have been playing the roles of villains in this story since the 70s anyway. That is, the schools confirm the notion that you don't need a family, all right? You don't need a father in the home. Schools have been preaching that for 40 years now. And schools have been overriding the wishes of the parents themselves in exposing children to, you know, perversity, not just the ordinary run of sexual sin, but the perverse order of it, too. It's all wonderful for school people to complain. Yeah, you know, some of these kids they don't have real families. Well, what the heck has the schools been doing? But preaching just those things that would destroy families.
And the other thing that you point up too is just breaking this mindset, not just getting beyond the compulsory education through high school to colleges, and the idea that it's a indisputable good trying to provide scholarships for people that don't have the means to go to college, and maybe that's not an indisputable.
Yeah, no. What we need very much, and I say this as a college professor, I understand. I've been in higher education since I was a freshman in college. I've never been apart from it. I've observed it close up. I believe that it functions as a cartel or a monopoly. It has established itself as the gatekeeper for access to all kinds of good things, for which it itself contributes nothing. or very little, right? It's as if you happen to own the only bridge across a river. And this was actually omitted by the editors of the piece that I wrote for American Greatness. I don't know why they omitted it. You own the bridge across the river, and people have to cross that bridge. And you've got it. You've got control there. It's an artificial bottleneck. And then you charge people through the nose for going across that bridge. The colleges have established themselves as the turnpike keeper or the gatekeeper. But there's no reason for it. There's no reason why you have to go to college. What are you learning there in order to do almost any of the jobs that are out there in the United States right now? College education does not actually contribute anything towards your having that job, right? College education is for entry into the intellectual life. It's not for everybody. But that's not why people are going to college. People are going to college in order to get the sheepskin so that they can provide it to an employer and get a job from it. I don't know whether it actually does that, but even if it did that, it would be illegitimate.
That's the toll at the bridge. The bridge to employment is that sheepskin.
Right. That's against Catholic social teaching, okay?
When we come back with Tony Esselin, I want to get his take on what conservatives should do with respect to higher education. More with Tony right after this.
Listen to podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. We're speaking with Magdalen College writer-in-residence Anthony Esselin about higher education. And Tony, for conservatives, what is the most productive path when it comes to trying to improve options for conservatives interested in preserving Western civilization and higher education and thoughtful intellectual pursuits?
Well, we absolutely need higher education, okay? There are things that you can't do without it. So I'm totally in favor of multiplying the number of places like Magdalen College, where I teach, or Hillsdale College, right? Mm-hmm. These are specifically places for entry into the intellectual life on a rather high level. They're not training grounds for jobs that you will get later, okay? They're kind of what liberal arts colleges always were. They're modeled after what John Henry Newman has in his mind, in his work, The Idea of a University. We should be infiltrating. You got to make the best of a bad situation. So we should be, of course, having a greater presence in such places as are out there, the Harvards of the world, and even state colleges. But what really needs to happen, okay, for all kinds of reasons, is to break that, what I call the higher education employment nexus. That's got to be broken because that's unjust, right? That you should be required to have a college degree for entry into almost any job, right, in the country. I mean, there are really very few jobs that ought to require that college degree. That connection is primed to be smashed. It saves a lot of people tremendous amount of money and a lot of time, and it would get the colleges perhaps back to doing what higher education ought to do, rather than just serving as an extremely expensive 4-year spa, where young people take worthless classes, and sometimes worse than worthless, downright poisonous, downright harmful. This is all to the good of people of the lower middle class, the working class, and the underclass generally, right? And some people say, well, you know, why don't we just give more money to the colleges so they can have more scholarships for these people? And so that, you know, that's like giving money to the racketeers. They already have been running a racket. The thing to do is to smash the racket and give people of poorer means ways of attaining jobs that avoid the turnpike.
He is Anthony Esselin, professor and writer in residence at Magdalen College of the Liberal Arts, author of The Hundredfold, Songs for the Lord, and Sex and the Unreal City, that is, The Demolition of the Western Mind. Tony, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks.
Take care.
This is the Dan Proft Show. The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show, and one of the reasons that blue states, deep blue states with deep blue big cities are such sewers is because the leadership that could come from outside of the political realm or that could hold those erstwhile ruling class politicians accountable decides instead to throw in with them, no matter how ridiculous their reigns are. And Chicago is ground zero for that. The latest piece of evidence I'd like to submit for your consideration. Dear Mayor Lightfoot, today Chicago, like cities across our nation, is at a crossroads. The pandemic, racial strife, and recession are a triple threat. Oh, interesting choice of phraseology, considering you're talking to the triple threat. Right. I'm black, female, lesbian. That makes me a triple threat. Lori Lightfoot's value proposition as a candidate for mayor. Mm-hmm. The pandemic, racial strife, and recession are a triple threat to our hometown. We commend you and your team for your steadfast leadership in navigating the city through the crisis. High marks for Lori Lightfoot and her team of socialist facilitators for their stewardship during the last 2 years. Is that what you would give Lori Lightfoot? High marks? While the task ahead is daunting, Chicago has a unique opportunity to rebuild in a way that ensures we emerge stronger, fairer, and more resilient. This is all an all-hands-on-deck moment. No one can rebuild our beloved city alone. Only when our political leaders, the business community, civic groups, religious organizations, nonprofits, and cultural institutions join forces with a shared vision and effort, can we succeed. And what's that shared vision? So today, as business leaders responsible for employing thousands of Chicagoans, we're stepping up to stand with you and the Chicago Community Trust. We support Together We Rise for an Equitable and Just Recovery, the initiative you announced on October 8th to ensure an equitable and just recovery through financial and in-kind investments. And it's signed by a lot of champagne socialists, to be fair, but also George McCaskey, Chairman of Chicago Bears, Rocky Wirtz, Blackhawks, Jerry Reinsdorf over at the White Sox, Joe Mansueto, Chicago Fire, you know, many other CEOs. Again, many of them are champagne socialists who are otherwise doyens of the left anyway. But nonetheless, do you want to understand why? Why the decisions that are made? Why you can have failure perpetuated in spite of so many talented people, in spite of so many great institutions, or at least once great institutions? It's because, as they say in their letter, everybody throws in with the mayor, no matter how much of a cynical, identitarian, incompetent hack she is, and her socialist facilitators on the city council and in charge of so many of these institutions. And that's how you get the worst governed city in America in the worst governed state in American history. For more on blue state sewers, we're pleased to be joined again by Steve Malanga, who is at the Manhattan Institute, contributing editor to City Journal. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
How are you?
Good. You've written recently on an aspect of these blue state sewers, as I term them, and that is with respect to infrastructure, something politicians like to carry on about and sometimes fall considerably short of delivering. So, for example, it is worth noting that Illinois, the transportation hub of the Midwest, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, gets grades like this for its bridges, roads, and transit. You know, our comparative advantage, transportation infrastructure, C's and D pluses. And boy, you'd be shocked to hear that after Governor Pritzker doubled the state gas tax just a couple of years ago, and you've had intermittent multi-billion dollar infrastructure investment projects, shovel ready, so on and so forth. But it turns out these big blue states with big blue transportation systems are big money pits, Steve.
Yeah, actually, that's been an issue for a very long time. One of the things that struck me a couple of years ago was I was looking at a whole bunch of blue states that were talking about raising taxes as that kind of cycle got on. And at the same time, I was writing a piece on infrastructure, and there are all these, you know, ratings of infrastructure quality that are done by, you know, non-political, you know, groups like the engineers and so forth. And it struck me that the highest tax states that I was looking at also had the worst infrastructure in the country. And I said to myself, how is this possible? Not only that, but the best infrastructure rated were places like Texas and Florida, which don't even have an income tax. Tennessee with very low rates. And it really boggles my mind. I actually eventually wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal about this thing. There seems to be no relationship between the high tax blue state model and quality. And I went into a whole bunch of areas, not just infrastructure. I looked at things like education. I looked at things like housing affordability, inequality. You know, people talk so much about inequality, and it's mostly progressives who talk about it. But the places that are most unequal are the progressive states that are taxing people the most in order to end inequality, according to their. So there's no actual parallel between high tax rates and quality of services. And you have to assume that that's because the high taxes are actually being, if you will, swallowed up by big government, not necessarily being put to effective uses.
Well, that's it. And actually, in Illinois, just to punctuate what you were saying, Jimmy John Liatu, the founder of the Jimmy John sandwich franchise, that's exactly what he said several years ago when he moved his corporate headquarters out of Illinois. And remember, his business started in Champaign, central Illinois, to Florida. And he said, you know, look, I've been successful in life. I'm happy to pay taxes. The thing that riles me about Illinois is the money I send to Springfield doesn't go where they say it's going to go. And there was somebody that was actually connecting inputs to outputs, which very few people do, including all of the so many of the corporate titans and other civic and institutional leaders. Illinois has the highest combined state and local tax burden in the country. And yet you just heard the grades with respect to the state's infrastructure. We're one of the worst states in the nation when it comes to providing services to the developmentally disabled. We have some of the worst school systems in the country, starting in Chicago. So I'm sorry, what is the return on my investment?
Well, and here's something else, okay? You asked this question, why are states that are collecting so much in taxes and always raising taxes, why are they ineffective? And I'll tell you something else that recently just came out. Just a couple of days ago, the University of Chicago, the University of Illinois at Chicago's Department of Political Science, every periodically they do a corruption index for the states. And they basically measure how many people have been indicted by the federal government by state. And if you look at the long term over the last 20 to 30 years, Illinois is number one. California is number two. New York, the Southern District, Manhattan, is number three. So you have to think to yourselves, right? If you have governments that are persistently corrupt and they're collecting a lot of taxes, you know, maybe there's a relationship, right? You look at the fact that it costs so much in some of these blue states to actually build infrastructure because they do things like pay off their political supporters with things like prevailing wage provisions and all these other things that drive up the cost. And so you look at the study that comes out just a couple of days ago, and, you know, the most corrupt places in terms of indictments of public officials are, you know, three very, very blue areas. And so you have to wonder, is there a relationship between that and the fact that you have poorer services than you should be getting?
Well, that's what interesting, because the Sacramento Bee just recently opined on this, the Democrat political class corruption in California, and sort of lamenting, and this is the Sacramento Bee, which is, you know, not exactly a conservative outlet, lamenting that probably nobody will listen to Republicans in a state that's supermajority Democrat controlled. Yeah, well, maybe if the fourth estate wasn't also throwing in with the government for the past half century, maybe some more people would wake up and would listen. But that's precisely it. I say this all the time. When people ask, does the mafia still exist in Chicago? I say it sure does. It's just that in the 21st century, we call them alderman, state rep, state senator, governor, mayor?
Well, you know, there seems to be some kind of a relationship there. The most interesting thing, though, and I don't really know how to interpret this, is that as the Democratic Party moves more and more to the left, the people on the left are attacking, I guess, what you would call establishment Democratic corruption. For better or for worse, they're looking, of course, to replace that whole group. And so if we see what's going on in New York, where Governor Cuomo, who for years has been bulletproof because he could count on his allies in the Democratic Party, suddenly there are very left-of-center people up in Albany in places of power, and they're doing investigations, and now every day there's bad news about Cuomo, and suddenly this guy went from being an Emmy Award winner to now they're trying to mount an impeachment of him. And, of course, Gavin Newsom in California is in a recall battle, and the though it was started by a lot of Republicans and people on the right, people on the left are joining it, Democrats are joining it, and that's his problem right now. So there's a weird dynamic going on in America where both the right and the far left are saying, let's get rid of the establishment people who've run these places, and we're seeing some really, you know, a real political upheavals as a result of that.
Except in Illinois. Steve Malanga, Manhattan Institute, contributing editor, City Journal. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. It was Justice Robert Jackson who observed in the West Virginia v. Barnett case that compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. Well, that seems to be the raison d'etre of the Democrat Socialist Party these days and their ideological fellow travelers on college campuses. A couple of examples. Two House Democrats from California, Reps Anna Eshoo and Jerry McInerney, sent a demand letter essentially this week to CEOs of communications companies demanding to know what they're doing to police unwelcome speech. Unwelcome speech. Our country's public discourse is plagued by misinformation, disinformation, conspiracy theories, and lies, and somebody needs to do something about it. There ought to be a law, apparently. And they rely on Harvard University's Yochai Benkler and this research he's supposedly done into conservative media, which concludes the following. Our analysis underscores not only the enormous power of right-wing media, but also their distinctiveness from left-wing media. The conservative network of outlets, with Fox at its center, feeds a large minority of Americans narratives that confirm their biases, fills them with outrage at their political opponents, and isolates them from views that contradict these narratives. It's a closed propaganda feedback loop. Left-leaning media, whatever the goals of some of their members, have failed to produce anything similar, our analysis found. Benkler, a loyal Elizabeth Warren donor, doesn't see anything going on in left-wing media that he describes as happening in so-called conservative media, which, of course, is a fraction of the size and scope of an influence of the D.C. press corps. Over at Stanford University, academics Victor Davis Hanson, Neil Ferguson, Dr. Scott Atlas recently penned a letter describing how they had been defamed by four professors at Stanford who had recently met with the Stanford Faculty Senate and, as they describe it in their piece, published a farrago of falsehoods directed against various fellows of the Hoover Institution. And even the president, while defending them on the basis of academic freedom, these Hoover Institution scholars, VDH, Atlas, and Ferguson, appeared to concede the underlying charge that, you know, maybe these academics, conservative in orientation, had said some things that were untrue or misleading. For more on this state of affairs in the state of America, we're pleased to be joined again by Roger Rehm, who's the president of the Fund for American Studies. Roger, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Dan. Part of the powerful right-wing media that
Exactly. We figured we'd go right to the source, to the guy who's turning all the knobs and pulling all the levers, Roger Rehm at the Fund for American Studies. I mean, it is sort of ironic and dangerously so. On the one hand, they have to manufacture something about right-wing media in order to stifle right-wing media for manufacturing.
That's right.
Things.
I mean, all I could say was, George Orwell, please call your office. I mean, it's right out of 1984.
this woke culture that wants to censor any opinions that differ from what they view as acceptable. And it's frightening that it's come to the United States of America, which was founded on one of its principles was free speech, freedom of expression, protected in the First Amendment to our Constitution. And now they're trying to curtail it.
And it should be. Yeah, right. And of course, as you know, it's prosaic, although apparently not to some percentage of the population, the idea that, you know, the First Amendment was a protection against unpopular speech because popular speech doesn't need much protection. And to me, in addition to sort of the sort of bootstrapped research of the Harvard professor that I referenced, I mean, you know, it's really something when you can try to take out noted historians, I mean, accomplished academics like Victor Davis Hanson and Neil Ferguson and Dr. Scott Atlas. I mean, that's not just anybody. And it's one of those, if those guys can get eliminated from the public arena, then who can't?
That's right. I mean, the left has a different narrative about everything, about our country, the way it was founded. In their view, we aren't an exceptional country. Our founding date was 1619, not 1776, and so you know they're going to find anything that is said by historians on the so-called right to be misinformation, and therefore grounds for shutting it down. And so it's a very frightening trend that Americans need to wake up to and do something about and speak out about. And when you have two members of Congress writing a letter to Amazon saying you've got to drop Fox News from your services, I mean, that is just frightening that that's happening in this country.
And so then how does that redound into all of the programs the Fund for American Studies operates, which you know, you're at the head of that, and the conversations among academics and students that are ongoing against this backdrop that we're describing?
That's a great question because, you know, I've been involved in this for 30 years working at the Fund for American Studies, and I've seen how students have changed over the years, and they come to us now, unfortunately, sadly, really, with this idea that the American dream is dead. You can't, you know, go as far as your talents and abilities and perseverance will take you. They've, in many cases, come to accept the culture of dependency we're building in this country. And they also come to us less prepared in terms of their knowledge of American history, of civics, of the tools of economics in order to make a difference in the world. I mean, they're well-meaning young people today. They want to improve the world, but you're just not prepared to do it. And so we've got to do a lot of remedial work to really give them the tools of economics, teach them about America's founding ideas, you know, encourage them to be courageous leaders willing to speak out, even if it's unpopular.
And this is, you know, a relatively a small slice of the overall universe of young people that are participating in fund programs that are at least intellectually curious enough to be generally speaking open-minded to having scales drop from their eyes. You have wide swaths of the rest of their cohorts who aren't even there.
That's right. And, you know, most young people of the generation in college today, they've had no firsthand experience or examples of, you know, the worst of socialism and communism that our generation had. You know, we could look at the Soviet Union or China under Mao and see what forbidding places those were and how evil those systems were, that they controlled the lives of their own people. And while that's somewhat true today with China and becoming increasingly true, it's not something that young people in our country really understand. And, you know, that's one reason we sponsored these two Venezuelans.
Yeah, great. Fantastic.
You've had on your show, and, you know, traveling the country and warning young people in this country of the destructive effects of authoritarian socialism.
And what's on the horizon for the Fund for American Studies in the coming year or years even?
I appreciate you asking that. I mean, we've got exciting plans to really reach lots of more young people, both at the high school and college level through programs we have for teaching economics, teaching about our founding principles, and really trying to identify those who will be courageous leaders in the future, who have the will be willing to speak out in favor of our freedom and seek office. You know, we've got an alum who's been elected recently as head of the Republican minority in the Illinois State Senate. We've got an alum on the Supreme Court in Arizona, and we have powerful alums in the media like you, Dan, and like Mark Levin and others. So we're working very hard to get our alumni into places where they can have influence for good in our country.
He is Roger Rehm, the president of the Fund for American Studies. Get more information on their programs and support their programs, tfas.org. Roger, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you. Thanks, Dan.
Brought to you by the Fund for American Studies. The Fund for American Studies is an educational nonprofit that is changing the world by developing leaders for a free society, offering transformational programs that teach the principles of limited government, free market economics, and honorable leadership to students and young professionals in America and around the world. Download a free ebook to learn how you can become a champion for liberty at teachingfreedom.org. That's why I'm easy.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. Interesting piece at the Public Discourse by Anthony Davies, who's a professor of economics at Duquesne University. He's also a Friedman scholar at Foundation for Economic Education. He and his wife, he talks about having kids. He and his wife started out thinking they'd have two, and they wound up with six. What did you learn from having many children? He writes, humans are hands down the single most fascinating set of creatures on the planet. If you want to understand how humans work, just make a few. Sit back and watch them do their thing. But one or two won't do. To understand humans, you need to observe enough of them so the individual quirks average out and you get to see the commonality in their behaviors. How many are enough? Probably several hundred thousand. As that was outside our budget, we settled for six. And then he goes through some of the insights he gleaned from his six kids. It's very, very good read, and it speaks to the larger question of the fertility issue, the population growth, getting to replacement rate, including but not limited to through immigration in this country. And that is a subject that our next guest has written about extensively, including a recent piece called Escaping the Parent Trap. He is Lyman Stone, research fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, chief information officer of the population research firm Demographic Intelligence, and adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Lyman, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So Professor Davies, they thought they'd have two, and they went up to six, and it sort of speaks to something that you write about in your most recent piece I referenced and we've discussed with you before, which is that right now in America, it may surprise people to know that women and families are saying that they actually are having less children than they otherwise desire to have.
That's right. So we have a whole lot of surveys where we ask people, how many children would you ideally have? How many children do you want to have? How many children do you intend to have? You know, we ask all these different question wordings. And pretty much uniformly, we find that people want somewhere between like 2.1 and 2.8 kids, right? Of course, nobody actually wants 2.5 kids, but they want two or three or something like that.
Right.
But on average right now, fertility rates are such that a woman who's coming of age today, if birth rates remain constant throughout her life, would only have less than 1.7 children each, which means that she's likely to have a major shortfall between the number of kids she wants to have and the number of kids she actually has. Now, there have been shortfalls in the past. This isn't a brand new thing. We actually see this in a lot of countries in a lot of time periods. But the current gap is one of the largest that we've ever seen.
Well, and you make a point, too, about the way we message on it from the perspective not of the sort of apocalyptic leftist like AOC who suggests there's no point in having kids because the world's going to end in 10 years, but from the perspective of people who want to repopulate the species, who say we want people to have kids. But at the same time, we're saying it in the context of we have this fertility crisis that you're describing. We're not at replacement rate. We need immigration, so we need you to have more kids. And, you know, you suggest maybe that's not the best way to sell having three or four or five kids as opposed to having zero, one, or two.
Exactly. So all too often we have what I call the paradox of pronatalism, which is that governments kind of tell people – governments look around, they say, oh, gosh, fertility rates are so low, that's going to be horrible for the economy, maybe. That's you know, one thing people might say. And they say, we need to boost fertility, so let's go tell everybody that fertility is too low and we need them to have babies and give them, I don't know, money for it or something. The problem is if you go to all the potential parents and you say the future is going to be terrible, we need you to have babies. All those parents go, I don't know, if the future is going to be terrible, maybe I don't want to have babies.
Right. Not to mention, so, I'm not sure I want the state driving the amount of children I'm supposed to have.
Sure, precisely. So my perspective is that the government should not be setting a target fertility rate or something. We don't need to have central planning for baby making. That's not the goal here.
Right.
Instead, what we should do is we should just listen to the preferences people have. People do tell us how many they want, and they also tell us why they don't have them. And it's not because they just decided later on they didn't want them. We actually have really good longitudinal analysis that allows us to kind of parse out that.
Let's hold it right there because we call in the business a tease, as you know. Let's hold it right there about why they're not having the kids that they want to have. Get that on the other side of the break. More with Lyman Stone, research fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, chief information officer of the population research firm Demographic Intelligence, and adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We'll be right back with more.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. We're speaking with Lyman Stone, research fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, chief information officer of the population research firm Demographic Intelligence, and adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And we left you hanging with the break there, why people, families, are not having the amount of children they say they desire to have. And Lyman, let's pick it up there. Why is it?
I would say there's basically three big families of reasons, and those are time, money, and marriage. That is, the money one's simplest. Having kids is expensive, there's costs, and people often don't have the money. And, you know, 200 years ago, even if having a child was expensive, it was retirement insurance. Right? That child might provide for you when you're older. Today, parents don't expect to reap economic returns from their children. And in fact, it's very difficult legally to do so. So we've actually changed the economic direction of transfers here, which changes the economic calculus. Then there's also a time problem. People spend years and years in school and all these things that sort of postpones adulthood. Beyond that, married couples collectively work more hours than in the past. If you work a lot of hours, you don't have a lot of time to spend with kids, which means parenting is less fun, because what's fun about parenting is being with your kids. There's all sorts of time concerns around parental leave from work, vacation time, all these things. But then the actual biggest reason is about partnership or marriage. Marriage is getting increasingly delayed. People are getting married later. And even though a lot of births happen outside of marriage, marriage still causes people to have a dramatic increase in their odds of becoming pregnant and having a child. And so as marriage is delayed, that stability that allows people to say, okay, I think it's a good idea to bring a child into the world, that period comes later too. And as those things come later, it's more difficult to achieve fertility desires.
And is it the same dynamic at play in terms of why it's coming later, why marriage is coming later? So it's coming later and that creates a smaller window. There's a reason it's coming later, and it's sort of the same reasons as the larger issue of the number of children people have versus what they want, which is to say all of those buckets you mentioned, and also sort of just this idea of, I don't know, the individualization or the atomization of life in the West, where there's a lot more perhaps navel gazing going on than there used to be in a bygone era.
Yeah. So there's, of course, things about, you know, timing of life and this sort of thing. But I think one of the big transitions we've seen in marriage is between sort of marriage as an investment versus capstone marriage. So capstone marriage is the idea that once you get your life in order, and you've got the job and you've got the house or whatever, then you cap it off with a marriage. And marriage mm-hmm. is like a sign that you have everything in order. And that model of marriage is becoming increasingly prevalent, that instead of marriage being something you do in the progress to sort of achieving the life you want, marriage is like the reward you give yourself after you've achieved everything that you want. So this idea contributes to marriage being delayed. You have a lot of people saying, well, you know, I can't get married yet because I don't have a stable job. You say, well, why does that prevent you from being married? Because marriage is a thing you do once you're stable, rather than the idea that marriage is something you do in order to become stable.
Yes, and also, and you sort of addressed this in your piece too, the idea that marriage and family is part of a life well lived. You know, there's a sort of a value appeal to it that maybe isn't as pronounced as it used to be with the increasing secularization in society.
That's possible. The evidence on this is very complicated because on the one hand, we do see growing shares of people in surveys saying that like they don't think marriage is essential for a happy life. At the same time, the share of people who say that they want to get married has essentially been unchanged in decades. And the average age at which people say they want to get married has not actually changed all that much. So I think what we've seen is a lot of people becoming more uncomfortable about proclaiming general ideals. That is, we're seeing more people uncomfortable with saying, you know, to be happy, you have to be married. But we are not seeing a big change in the extent to which people desire marriage for themselves. I think this is related to this broader problem about, like, you know, we see a lot of, like, especially sort of progressive people talking about how, oh, marriage isn't necessary for happiness, all these things, and we need to do this very progressive family talk. And then in their own lives, they're in a stable marriage with 2.5 kids and white picket fence. And you think, well, gosh, if you were practicing what you're preaching, your life would look different. So I wonder which one of these is what you really believe.
Yeah, right. Or preaching what you practice is. Yeah, right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And so I wonder then with what if any evidence there is to support some of the government engineering programs that continue to abound. You sort of mentioned family leave being one of them. We have in the context of pandemic recovery, a whole new round of proposed child tax credits and so on and so forth. Do those government inducements matter?
They do. Government policies have an influence on fertility. That's a pretty clear finding from virtually all academic research. The size of that influence varies depending on the policy and how you study it, but there is an influence. I think it's important to understand that some policies are more sort of government social engineering than others. So take the child dependent care tax credit. There's a tax credit you only get if you have kids and all adults in the household are employed. So it's basically, we take households that already have two employed people, which is higher earning households. And also you can't claim it if you're very poor because you don't have enough tax liability. So we take households that are already rather well-to-do. They have two earners and relatively high incomes. And then we give them an extra tax credit to pay for their child care. Okay. But if you are a household where one person stays at home, there's no support for you. So this is a case of government social engineering pretty emphatically trying to encourage a specific model of family. That is two workers, kid in daycare. Okay. Whereas a child allowance, like this proposal that Mitt Romney's put forward recently, is not like that. Basically, everybody gets it. It's not going to discriminate based on family structure, which means the biggest beneficiaries of this are actually going to be married couples where maybe one spouse would prefer to stay at home, but they can't really afford it. That's really the group here that stands to gain the most from a child allowance. So I think that we shouldn't just think of everything the government does as like government social engineering, because some policies facilitate people making a variety of choices, whereas other policies specifically favor certain choices that the government wants to approve. That is, they pick winners or losers.
That's a good distinction. He is Lyman Stone, Research Fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, Chief Information Officer of the population research firm Demographic Intelligence, and Adjunct Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Lyman, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. And just looking ahead to CPAC this weekend and the back and forth we talked about earlier in the program between the press and McCarthy and Liz Cheney with respect to Trump speaking and Trump's role in the future of the party and Mitt Romney weighing in, so on and so forth. This, you know, running division of some sort, although it represents a sliver of the Republican Party, the Never Trumpers, but between the Never Trumpers who are still in positions of some profile like Liz Cheney and the rank and file out there in advance of CPAC, and with those who supported Trump's impeachment within the Republican ranks making the rounds on cable like Adam Kinzinger from Illinois does, and also announcing their own efforts to pick up where the Lincoln Project has left off because of the Lincoln Project's implosion on itself for suborning a alleged predator in John Weaver as one of its principal founders, you know, all like rats from a sinking ship, the George Conways and the Steve Schmitz and others run from the Lincoln Project. So perhaps that won't be a going concern in the coming cycle, but there will be others. For example, the story from the Washington Examiner. Centrist GOP group promises $25 million to win back Congress. Centrist GOP group. Your spidey sense should be tingling if you're a conservative. And the reveal is in the first graph in David Drucker's piece over at The Examiner. The Centrist Republican Main Street Partnership plans to invest $25 million in swing House districts in 2022 to help the GOP recapture Congress and halt the advance of conservative provocateurs loyal to former President Donald Trump. Centrist GOP group. We've seen this before. The Lincoln Project was characterized as a centrist GOP group, even center right. Oh, good, you know, Republicans there, George Conway, Bill Kristol. Yeah. So advisors to John McCain, like Steve Schmidt and John Weaver. Oh, sure. And now we have Bill Kristol writing op-eds over at The Bulwark, how Never Trumpers can become work with Joe Bideners. It's also reminiscent of another center right group, David Frum's No Labels. And that No Labels organization, short-lived as it was, much like the Lincoln Project likely will be, their entire focus, while they're talking about, oh, how we recapture the House and GOP control and so on and so forth, their entire focus was preventing the Freedom Caucus from being preeminent within the House Republican Caucus, the Jim Jordans of the world. They spent no time talking about socialists and defeating socialists. It was all Freedom Caucus. And so here we go again. We're going to help you win the majority. But what we need to do is really purge conservative provocateurs from the party, which, by the way, is a strategy to guarantee minority status and ultimately perhaps super minority status or certainly total marginalization when it comes to the making of the rules of the game in this country. The ordering of a free society to the extent it can be maintained. Main Street Partnership, Adam Kinzinger's thing, Lincoln Project, No Labels. Anytime you see centrist GOP group is going to help, but there's a catch. Understand the rationale for their existence is solely the catch. It is the latter, not the former. These are the sorts of things you learn by listening to the show and just by being a keen observer. Thanks for joining us on another edition of the program. Please continue to stay informed so you can behave courageously and we can live freely. And join us again tomorrow on the Dan Prof Show.
This is the Dan Prof Show.